Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I'm Mark Hutchinson. I'm a member of this church. Welcome to everybody who's watching or listening online, whether now or sometime in the next week or two when you're desperate to hear what we said. And of course, those of you here can go and listen to it again if it was so good that you think you need to listen to it again. Feel free. Feel free. Some opening words from Alan Rain. People may spend their whole lives climbing the ladder of success, only to find when they get there, the top of the ladder is leaning against the wrong wall. Unitarian congregations around the world light their chalice flame. And we gather as Unitarians, old and new friends, seeking truth, love, meaning, and deep connection. We respect the integrity of our individual selves, even as we are shown the interconnectedness of all that is. We bring our own ingredients to our spirituality today and every day, and we light this chalice, the symbol of our open, creedless faith, for holding and being held. And before we sing and join our voices together, another short set of words from Tyler Cohen. This is entitled "Lower Your Threshold for Taking Action." At critical moments in time, you can raise the aspirations of other people significantly, especially when they are relatively young, simply by suggesting they do something better or more ambitious than what they had in mind. It costs you very little to do this, but the benefit to them and the broader world may be enormous. This is, in fact, one of the most valuable things you can do with your time and with your life. Let's sing together. Let's bring our voices together. It's number 26. Holy, holy, holy. Some words from John O'Donoghue for presence. Awaken to the mystery of being here and enter the quiet immensity of your own presence. Have joy and peace in the temple of your senses. Receive encouragement when new frontiers beckon. Respond to the call of your gift and the courage to follow its path. Let the flame of anger free you of all falsity. May warmth of heart keep your presence aflame. May anxiety never linger about you. May your outer dignity mirror an inner dignity of soul. Take time to celebrate the quiet miracles, the ones that seek no attention. Be consoled in the secret symmetry of your soul. May you experience each day as a sacred gift woven around the heart of wonder. Amen. And here at Dublin, we have a reader each week, and I'll ask John to come forward in a second. But before I do that, I want to read, I think this is a New Year's Day tweet. Am I allowed to say tweet these days? I'm not sure I am. Or even to read one out. But I am doing. And it's from Jonathan Haidt, psychologist and writer. I'm sure some of you will know him. New Year's resolutions for a world choking on outrage. I will give less offence. In brackets, i.e. be more polite. Close brackets. I will take less offence. Open brackets. Give others the benefit of the doubt. Close brackets. I will pass on less offence. Open brackets. i.e. not be the sort of retweeter Russian trolls want me to be. Close brackets. And I always like to see if you're listening by asking a question or two. So this is a New Year's tweet on December the 31st. What year was that tweet sent? Any takers? 2011. Have we got any? Ooh, 20. Was Twitter even around then? 2017. Have we got any other offers? We've a 2011 or 2017. It's 2018. It's 2018. But I find it quite depressing that that's 2018. Because I thought things were a bit better then. I'll leave you to our reader now, and I'll return to that. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I won't be asking any questions, so you can relax. One of the things that I most enjoy about coming to this congregation is that I rarely leave it without some comment reverberating or resonating with me. Usually it's a comment said in the church. Another time it's said downstairs at tea, but usually it's said in the church. And I don't think I've ever left this congregation without being touched by something that somebody has said. So all I want to do this morning briefly is to add a thought to that plate. Listening to Mark, I think that plate will be pretty full. He's already started to add to it, and I'm sure he'll be adding an awful lot more to it. So the idea I just want to add to it is that as we go through life, we accumulate a lot of precious things, and I'm really talking about friends, family, those that we love, precious things. And we all have to deal with the loss of those things. So the idea I want to put forward is to think of those precious things as more loaned to us than given to us. So I'll do the reading, say a few quick words about it, and then repeat the reading. It's a poem I wrote about 10 years ago. And the metaphor being used is the idea of gathering precious stones. And there's a keeper of stones. And the keeper of stones I call God, the light, transient, whatever is most value to you, so whatever you interpret God to be. So, the keeper of the stones. I have seen you gathering stones at twilight along the shores of your hopes and dreams, pausing now and then to brush the sand away, glimpsing the beauty of what lay at your feet. You took them as if they were yours to keep, storing them in precious places of the heart, thinking that if you but held them tightly, that life would never wrench them from your grasp. Destined to slip away as all things must, they beguiled your soul with certainty, as if the chains of love and longing could cheat the raging tides of change and time. But they were never yours, my beloved, for I am the keeper of the stones, briefly loaned to you as your spirit journeys in the brief moment of your walk along the shore. Though love and grief and boundless loss would seem at times to steal your precious stones, I keep them safe, for when you cross the tide and pass forever into the timeless sea. So the idea of the poem came from, I had the privilege of spending 15 years living beside a beach in the west of Ireland, a small town called Lewisburg. That's belonged to the county who won the recent football match. We don't talk about it very much, we don't boast about it. But it's a beautiful beach and a private one, only private because we don't tell anybody that's there. But my wife had a habit of collecting stones. I'm sure if you go on beaches, we tend to sometimes pick up a beautiful stone. So she used to collect the stones, and I was the one that had to carry them. And as the stones got bigger, the task of carrying them got bigger. I think it was the source of problems with my back over the years. But we kind of lose a lot of our stones, and I have to say that I probably had more of my fair share than losing precious stones. So I just thought of the idea of what if we thought of the precious things in our life, particularly love, as being loaned to us, and what does it say? Does it help us in terms of coping with the loss? So what does the loan idea say to us? it reminds us that this loan is temporary. We don't have permanent possession. It suggests that we actively enjoy the presence of those we love in all its imperfections, because as we probably all have figured out at this stage, you know, love has its imperfections, there's no doubt about it. And the central idea is that, and it's a kind of a cliche when you say love never dies, what do we mean by it? And I've often thought that if you love somebody, whether it's your children, your spouse, whatever, 40 years or whatever, and we lose them, surely that cannot just stop. It's just that we have different ways of thinking how love goes on. And one way of looking at it is that, depending on your spiritual views, is not so much, I don't believe in a personal God, I don't believe we're going to go to pearly gates and meet our people as we knew them, but there is a sense in which love is transformed in a way that we're not given to understand, and that's what I eagerly anticipate, but I don't know what shape it takes. Another favourite metaphor is the metaphor of the butterfly. If a butterfly lands on your hand, you're not going to grasp it. You're going to leave it there, watch it, enjoy it until it flies away again. You don't possess it. And my final reference is that beautiful Sufi poem which somebody read here a few months ago called The Guest House. And it just talks of the idea that everything in our lives are guests. In other words, it's a temporary stay. We enjoy them, we savour them when they're here, but they're going to leave. And I have found that a comforting idea in terms of trying to cope with the loss of precious things. So just to finish by reading the poem briefly again, The Keeper of the Stones. I have seen you gathering stones at twilight along the shores of your hopes and dreams, pausing now and then to brush the sand away, glimpsing the beauty of what lay at your feet. You took them as if they were yours to keep, storing them in precious places of the heart, thinking that if you but held them tightly, that life would never wrench them from your grasp. Destined to slip away as all things must, they beguiled your soul with certainty, as if the chains of love and longing could cheat the raging tides of change and time. But they were never yours, my beloved, for I am the keeper of the stones, briefly loaned to you as your spirit journeys and the brief moment of your walk along the shore, though love and grief and boundless loss would seem at times to steal your precious stones. I keep them safe for when you cross the tide and pass forever into the timeless sea. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Let's pray. Thank you for a day, one I never asked for. Perhaps I hoped for it. Maybe I even sometimes think I deserve it. Some days are irritating, some hilarious, some sad, some devastating. I'm not in desperate need of food. I'm not awaiting the sounds and smells of violence. In this never asked for day, I pray that everybody in the world together will wake up and say thank you. For this to happen on just one day. Amen. Apparently there's a children's club today. So I have a very short story to tell. And if they want to come forward, please do. Hello. Leo had the brightest tail in the meadow. Most fireflies flashed just to win the nightly glowing contest. But Leo, being Leo, wanted more. He dreamed of using his light for a big purpose. And one stormy night, the old owl's bridge over the brook broke. Oh no, I hear all of you saying. Okay, so you get a bit of participation, it always helps. The path was pitch black,
and it was full of sharp thorns. I'm not quite sure why the path was a problem for an owl, but we'll put that to one side. Leo didn't stay to play the glowing games that all the other glowworms were playing. There was no glow scrolling for Leo. He flew straight to the dark path. He shined his light as hard as he could, and he guided all the lost bugs and all the little animals safely home. Leo learned that having a big dream to help others is the brightest ambition of all. Now, if there's anybody here who's a little one, want to offer me a big dream? But you don't have to. Have you got a big dream that you'd like to tell me about? Something really big you'd like to do?
It doesn't have to be big, it can be little. It can be little.
I think your big dream is that there is actually a children's group today. And I think that works, so go and have a great time. I think it's time to get our voices working together again. And we'll sing number 23.
Thank you. So the title given today, Service Moral Ambition, is taken from Rutger Bregman's book at the beginning of last year. And I'm going to tell two or three stories out of that book. But before I do that, the opening few lines from the Psalm of David. Lord, who may dwell in your sacred tent? Who may live on your holy mountain? The one whose walk is blameless, who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from their heart, whose tongue utters no slander, who does no wrong to a neighbour and casts no slur on others, who despises a vile person but honours those who fear the Lord, who weeps an oath even when it hurts and does not change their mind, who lends the money to the poor without interest, who does not accept a bribe against the innocent. Whoever does these things will never be shaken. I hope you've all ticked those. Maybe sometimes. So a story from the book, and there'll be one or two of these as I go to the sermon, but we'll have a meditation in between. One of the most bizarre historical tales I've ever read is from the Journal of the English Sea Captain William Snelgrave. In 1714, he published an account of his life as a slave trader. He wrote about the time he was invited to a feast by the ruler of Ardra, a port town on the West African coast. Snelgrave didn't want to turn down the invitation because the king was a big supplier of slaves. But the captain thought the Africans fierce and fiendish cannibals, and so he remained on guard for them, sitting on a stool under some shady trees. Snelgrave presented his gifts, and he saw that he and his men were surrounded by at least 50 warriors with barbed lances and bows. Fortunately, the mood under the trees soon turned friendly. The king was delighted with his gifts, and the feast could begin. With the corner of his eye, the captain spotted a little boy. I guess a bit of a warning. It's not a pleasant story, this, just so you're aware. And he was very young. He couldn't have been more than 18 months old. And the child's leg was tied to a stake, with two priests standing by. I don't think I need to say the rest. But Snelgrove was appalled and said that the king couldn't possibly seize this child because it was his property. Snelgrave fired back that his faith expressly forbids so horrid a thing as putting a poor innocent child to death. And so he bought the child. Do you not know the law of grand human nature? Did His Majesty not know that you were to do unto others as you should have others do unto you? And as I say, Captain Snelgrove purchased the boy for a few blue beads, and the festivities picked up again, and everyone was in high spirits. The sailors and the warriors drank together, finishing off litres of palm wine. On their way back to the ship, Snelgrave asked one of his men if he couldn't find a motherly woman to care for the child. Certainly, said the sailor, just yesterday they'd bought a woman with much milk in her breasts. As soon as they again set foot on their slaving vessel, a black woman made straight for the little boy, snatched him out of the white man's arms that held him. It was the woman the sailor already had in mind, and she was the child's mother. I think, wrote Captain Snelgrives in his memoirs, there was never a more moving sight than on this occasion, between the mother and her little son. Not much later, the captain sailed to the Caribbean, where he sold the mother and son, along with 300 other captives. It's really tough thinking about moral ambition and the morals that hold us at different times in our own lives, never mind in the different times of humanity. But we need to remember that it's relative. It's easy to speak out against slavery today, but in the 18th century, that was pretty tough because it could get you killed. But the moral pioneers did take a leap. But none of them were perfect. Who of us are? So the abolitionist William Wilberforce in the UK fought against the slave trade with everything it had at his power. But he also thought that women's rights were nonsense. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was a feminist powerhouse who fought all her life for women's rights to get the vote, but had far less urgency about getting the vote for black men and women. And Martin Luther King apparently advised a young man with homosexual feelings to find a good therapist to rid himself of the problem. Moral pioneers aren't saints. They're simply leading the way. I'm glad moral pioneers aren't saints. That gives us all a chance to be moral pioneers. I know that's quite a heavy set. I'll maybe get a bit lighter when we get to the sermon. I don't know. But now let's have some time to have spoken word, guided meditation, and then it will be followed by some music. So please make yourself comfortable and prepare for a period of reflection.
This is a time for a friendship meditation, for interconnection to the world. If at any time you feel a little uncomfortable, do open your eyes and reconnect to the space. And if you can, think of a childhood connection, maybe friend, maybe family, and just feel the warmth and strength of that relationship. And let that warmth and energy express as colour, any colour. Your colour. For me, it's blue. Whatever the shade, this is your shade of friendship. A colour connection of friendship that can flow out anywhere and everywhere in the world. Follow the flow of that colour now. Maybe mountain or sea, city or desert. Just follow the flow. This is your colour. And wherever you are, just let it flow to some new people in this location. They may be new friends. It might be a friendship to renew. The colour might take you to somebody from a long time ago. Just feel your energy and colour flow of friendship. a short silence in that flow now. Thank you for friendship, for all of the friendship of the past, and all the friendship of the future. And as you are ready, if you wish to open your eyes, or if you prefer to leave your eyes closed as the music begins, thank you, thank you, thank you.
I'm afraid I need to ask you a question again. There's something wrong with me, I think. And even more than that, I need you to count as well. We'll see how it goes. So I'm going to read you four descriptions of the world. And please feel free to add up the number that you agree with. It can be zero, of course. So description one, the world's in awful shape. There's untold suffering among billions of people and animals. That's number one. Number two, the world's much better off than 3 centuries ago. We're healthier and wealthier than ever. Number three, the world can be a wildly better place. Just look at how much money and talent we're still wasting. And number four, the world's never been closer to its own demise. So just in case anybody was counting, has anybody got zero there? Anybody got one? You don't have to show in case you're a bit bothered about what everybody else has done. Anybody got two? We've got a two. Anybody got three? Anybody got four? And the abstentions win, which is good. You know, it's a simplistic thing. Again, this is from Rutger's book. I read all of those and go, I can agree with all of those. I might have kind of debates over the words, you know. I'm a Unitarian after all, so we've got to have a debate about the words, haven't we? But understanding where we're at and understanding our moral ambition, I've attempted to show so far that having that highest ambition is, of course, important. But the challenges of understanding what that ambition is and that the morality around it. So a couple of examples. You'll have maybe have heard of Olodé Equiano, who was an abolitionist who lived in England and was a middle class and a black person and supposedly owned African slaves. He was friends with a Quaker called Clarkson, and Clarkson was discovered by the Quakers, who were looking for somebody to help them in the abolition of slavery argument. And Clarkson had written, I think, the equivalent of a PhD about the slave trade and was putting out publicity about the number of slaves that were killed in the transfer across to America. But it was only when Clarkson changed the narrative of the media and talked about the number of sailors who died, not the number of slaves, that people started listening. And there is a really unpleasant fact, and this is no defence of anything, but I'm just stating it as a fact, that actually the percentage of sailors who died in the slave trade, percentage, not numbers, I hasten to add, was actually considerably higher, because the people who ran the ships had no incentive to keep the sailors alive, because there was nothing to sell at the end. Rugger in his book has this great set of illusions for us to contend with. You'll be glad to know I'm not going to do them all, but I am going to just offer you one or two little snippets. The illusion of good intentions. Another question for you. This is from Analysis Round the World. Between 1998 and 2022, an analysis of 1,557 climate policies. That's 1,557. How many of them made a significant reduction in carbon dioxide? Anybody care to give me a number of 15? Sorry? None. That's a good offer.
Four.
Well, we're getting the right idea. 63. I haven't examined whether that's an accurate reflection of the strength or not. And another one. In 2019, 40 to 70% of the donated medical devices were unused as either not functional or not appropriate or didn't have the correct training. I'd like to tell a story from my experience now. Over in the UK last summer, we had a series of demonstrations at asylum hotels. So it was over a couple of weekends. And I know similar things have happened here in Ireland. There was quite an unpleasant series of demonstrations, some of them violent. And I lived in a little town called Evesham at the time, and we had a little demonstration. Evesham wasn't a big town, so it was never going to be too big an event, but there was one. And so I went, and I arrived about half an hour after the due start time, and next to the hotel was about 30 or 40 of largely an unpleasant set of individuals, and on the other side, on the pavement, was about the same number of what I would loosely call my lot, so the progressive lot. And so I went over and said hello. There was a sign on each lamppost on our side which said, "All refugees welcome." I don't know whether you use that phrase over here in Ireland or not. I should have asked that question, but in the UK that gets used a lot. So they're there on the lamppost. And one of the people I knew well gave me a hug. "Lovely to see you, Mark. Great to have you with us on this side of the road." And I said, "Well, if I'm honest, I don't think I'm quite on this side of the road. I think I might be 2 or 3 feet into the road." And they said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, can you tell me what that sign means, 'All refugees welcome'?" So we then started having a discussion. And I said, "For me, the only interest I've got in that sign, 'All refugees welcome,' is what does that sign mean to all those people on the other side of the road? Because to me, what that sign means is we want to welcome every refugee in the world into our country. That's what that sign says." And they all said, "No, it didn't. It doesn't mean that at all." So, well, it might not mean that to you, but I'm pretty certain it'll mean that to them. And so we had a bit of a debate, and then this person I knew's daughter was there, and we had quite a session. And I looked across the road. I've been in Evesham 7 years, and I knew almost as many people on the other side of the road as I did on my side of the road. And so it all got a bit yucky. There was no violence, but there was lots of language, there was lots of unpleasantness, there was lots of social media abuse occurring at the same time about various people. Nothing wild, but yeah, is what I would describe it as. And the particularly unpleasant mouthpiece of the other side of the road wanders across, you know, I won't repeat the words. And so I stepped out into the road and shouted at him in the way that they could all hear, "That sign there, what does that mean to you?" I won't give you his response, obviously, but it was fairly explicit. And I shouted across to him and tried to get him to shut up, but couldn't really succeed. But I shouted and said, "There is not one person on that side of the road who thinks that we should welcome every refugee in the world. What they're saying, or at least I think they're saying, is that when they're here, we want to welcome every refugee, and we want to try and welcome as many refugees as we can. That's a very different statement. And the two people who were with him kind of mumbled and walked off. And this guy looked at me, put out his hand and said, "Oh, you're all right, you, aren't you?" and walked off. Now, I'm not saying that that particular interaction says anything magnificent about what may get changed, but it moved me, and it moved my little congregation in Evesham, and they have now got some funding to run what they're calling an agreeable disagreement day in Evesham to try and bring these two sides together. Not the horrible mouthpiece, and equally not those of us on our side who are totally definitive that we should try and welcome everybody, but the vast majority in the middle. It's a very small thing, but it's a little piece of glowworm, isn't it? It's a little attempt to do something. The section that I want to finish off from the book, there is a chapter entitled "Make It Your Moral Ambition to Win." Make it your moral ambition to win. And I've got a big long list of things that he assaults us general progressive people, if we are all that in this church, and I'm kind of thinking we're close to it. And I'm not going to list them out, but he gives us some stick, and quite often with some justification, by saying, if you actually stick to your guns of wanting to get X, then you might end up with a very horrible Y. And I think he's got a point. I can leave you to think about what that may mean for you, for something that's important for you. Because we do have to make decisions, and I'm so glad that I'm not the leader of a government. We do have to make decisions that are really hard to make about protecting people, about supporting people. And all that's in the background of a set of people, which is all of us, who make making those decisions quite tricky. And I've used it as the title today and told some of those difficult stories from the book to remind us that even great people of the past weren't all great. They did fantastic things, but they also had things that we would certainly view as not fantastic. And the idea of the glowworm is to remind us that it's wonderful if we can shine our light on something where we can. And that doesn't mean that we all have to run out of these doors and start dancing around Dublin and changing the world, although feel free to do that. But I'd like to just take you back to the opening quotation to finish from Tyler Cowen. And I didn't say this, he's actually an economist. Apologies for having an economist in a spiritual gathering. I can't help myself sometimes. Lower your threshold for taking action. At critical moments in time, you can raise the aspirations of other people significantly, especially when they are relatively young, simply by suggesting they do something better or more ambitious than what they might have in mind. It costs you relatively little to do this, but the benefit to them and to the broader world may be enormous. This is, in fact, one of the most valuable things you can do with your time and with your life. And I do think Unitarianism, with the power of its openness, our willingness to look for the next thing we can do as the right thing, I think we've got a strong chance to lower our threshold for taking action, and in so doing have a greater influence than we may otherwise do. Amen. So let's sing our next hymn, which is number 134. Afterwards we'll take the collection. Just a couple of quick notices. Thanks for everyone who contributed to the service this morning, and please do come and join us for your tea and coffee downstairs after the service. Our weekly service of reflection continues on Wednesday, as it always does, from 1:05 to 1:35. And the next Heart and Soul Contemplative Spiritual Gathering is on Monday the 17th of August at 7 p.m. And this session will be led by the Reverend Maud Robinson, who's volunteered to run this session. So please do let Maud know if you'd like to attend. I have her email address for anybody who wishes it. Last week, Gavin spoke about restarting the Justice and Peace Group, and if you'd like to get involved, please see the notice in our weekly email for details. So before we sing our final hymn, I'd just like to invite us just to sit quietly in silence together for 20 or 30 seconds. Thank you, and let's sing 118, This Little Light of Mine. And until we meet again, please remain open to the beloved of your heart. Amen.